Okay, great. Thank you, Brian. So as Brian said, his role here was to kind of give you an overview to talk about the motivation for this study, what was the point of it, and what we're going to do next. What I want to do is kind of go into the science of it, go into the methods, how we did this, and what we learned. So you'll have that sort of national perspective. And then after me, Debbie Boyer, who is the Director of Human Resources in the Oklahoma State Department of Health, is going to tell you what's really important about this, which is what they are already doing with the data in Oklahoma. And they're doing the kinds of things that any state health department can do with these data and show you what makes them so useful. So my name is Katie Sellers. I'm the Chief Science and Strategy Officer at the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. As Brian said, this project was a very close collaboration between ASTO and the foundation. We absolutely couldn't have done it without them, not just the money they provided, but the true collaboration, the making decisions together, the rolling the sleeves up and really being there every step of the way. I also want to acknowledge my other co-authors, J.P. Leiter, who was with the de Beaumont Foundation at the time we did this, Elizabeth Harper, who is at ASTO with me, Kieran Barthapudi, who was at ASTO until last week. He's moving back to India, so we will miss him. Rivka Liss-Levinson, who is actually in the audience today, played a pivotal role in this, and of course, Brian Kesterge. So what we did with the survey, what I want to talk to you about is that we looked at training needs with the survey. We also looked at national trends. So not only did we want to know what workers could tell us about what kind of training they needed, we also wanted to know what their perspectives on some of the national trends are. So things that we may think are really critical, really important things that are going on at the national level, what do frontline workers in state health departments or in local health departments, what do they think of these things? Have they heard of them? Do they think they're important? Do they think they're related to their jobs? We also asked questions about the workplace environment to get a sense of what it's like where they work, whether or not they have an opportunity to use whatever they learn in training as they do their jobs. And then, of course, we asked some questions about demographics and then after I go over all of this, I'll make some conclusions. So just to talk about the training needs, I know this is a pretty busy slide, but I want to just kind of orient you to what it is. You see the red bars. That represents the percentage of folks who told us that this particular skill was somewhat or very important to their current position. So if you look at the top one, you see the red bar is 72%. That means that 72% of workers said that influencing policy development is either somewhat important or very important to their current position. And then the blue bar shows you how they rated themselves. So the 41% on that blue bar says that's the percentage of those who said that, of those who said that it was somewhat or very important, that's the percentage who say that they're either unable to perform this or they're at a beginner level. So what we interpret the blue bars to mean is this is the training that people believe they need. So they would be open and receptive to this training. There may be other training that they need that they don't know they need, but because this was self-reported training needs, what we know is that 41% of those who said that influencing policy development is very important or somewhat important to their current job don't think their skills are good enough at it. So they would like some training in that area. So for the next one, we see preparing a program budget with justification. 62% think this is very important or somewhat important to their current position. 35% of those think their skills are not as good as they ought to be. 76% believe that understanding the relationship between a new policy and many types of public health problems, 76% believe that's very important or somewhat important, and 34% of those rate themselves at a low skill level. So if we just go down the blue bars, you know, this tells you what the training needs are. So 32% say that assessing the broad array of factors that influence specific public health problems, that's some training that they need. 31% say collaborating with diverse communities to identify and solve health problems. Still at about a third saying finding evidence on public health efforts that work is something they need training in. Ensuring that programs are managed within the current and forecasted budget constraints, another high training need. Applying evidence-based approaches to solve public health issues and addressing the needs of diverse populations in a culturally sensitive way. So this is, I've pulled out very specific items from PHWINS and I'm showing you the data here, but you can kind of see the trends here. There's some items on policy development, there's some items on budget and financial management, there's some items on evidence-based public health practice and diverse populations, inclusion, serving the needs of those populations. Okay, and then finally, these were some more training needs that we asked about, where you can see the blue bars are getting smaller and smaller. What's interesting about this slide is that as we start looking at some things that people think they're pretty good at, which if the blue bar is small, that means there aren't very many people who think they're not good at this. These are the things that they think are really important. So if you look at the bottom item here, gathering reliable information to answer questions, only 7% identified that as a training need, but 96% of people think that that's really important to their job or somewhat important. If you go up one from there, communicating ideas and information in a way that different audiences can understand, this one I think is really quite interesting. 92% say this is important to their current jobs. 11%, it's only 11% who think they need training in this area. What's so interesting to me about this is that a lot of the workers in this survey identified influencing policy development as something that was very important and they had training needs. Well, communicating ideas and information in a way that different audiences can understand, that's a key part of influencing policy development. If you're thinking about communicating with policymakers in a way that they understand, yet people are rating themselves quite highly on this. They're not seeing that this is a training need for them. So everything in PHWINS, you know, I would say a great value of this survey is that we're hearing from the actual workers. We're not, you know, as Brian said, we're not asking leaders to tell us what these folks need. So it's great that we're hearing from them on what they need and what their perspectives are on different things. But then we also have to take it with a grain of salt, because sometimes they may not recognize their training needs. Sometimes they may rate themselves as better at doing things than they actually are. And I just say that because I think we as a field of public health, we're not always great at conveying our information in a way that non-public health professionals are going to understand. If you go up one from there, communicating in a way that persuades others to act. Sometimes we can do that, but if we were really good at that, wouldn't we have more money? wouldn't we have the resources that we need to have a robust public health system? So that's what I want to say about the training needs. Again, if you look at these other ones, you can see you know, some of the same themes that I was talking about earlier. So now I'm going to move on to national trends. And first, I'll just orient you to these slides. I have a couple of these slides in this format. With each of the national trends, and there were eight, we asked people if they had heard of it, and then if they had heard of it, we asked them how important it was to public health in general. So this is not about their current position like the training needs questions were. This is about to the field of public health in general. Then we asked how much impact it would have on their actual day-to-day work. And then we asked how much emphasis should be placed on this trend in the future. So if you look at implementation of the Affordable Care Act, you can see that 92% had heard of it. Okay, not surprising. People had heard of it. If we had called it Obamacare, we might have gotten 100%. but 92% said they'd heard of implementation of the Affordable Care Act. 85% of those say that it's somewhat or very important to public health. But a much smaller portion, 43%, think that will impact their day-to-day work a fair amount or a great amount. And then 40% say that more emphasis should be placed on this trend in the future. So, you know, that's quite a bit less than half. I'm thinking people really are not looking to hear more about the Affordable Care Act. I think they've all heard of it, and they're not hungry for more about this particular item. If you look at health and all policies, you see a very different situation here. So for health and all policies, only 52% had heard of this. Of those who had heard of it, 86% think that it's very important to public health or somewhat important. But for only 46% think it's going to impact their everyday work. And then only 41% think there should be more emphasis on this. So that's kind of an interesting finding. If you look at evidence-based public health practice, about three quarters have heard of it. Those who have heard of it think it's very important. You can see that's a big red bar there. 69% think it is going to have an impact on their everyday work. And 48%, we're getting closer to half, say that there should be more emphasis on this in the future. When you look at the integration of public health and primary care, again, about three quarters have heard of it. You've got a big red bar. People think it's important. Half people think that it's going to impact their everyday work. And 52%, so over half now, are saying that more emphasis should be placed on this trend. Looking at public health systems and services research, the blue bar is not very big. We're not having a lot of recognition of this. But those who have heard of it think it's pretty important. We're at 85% there. Only 40% think it's going to have an impact on their job, and only 33% think there should be more emphasis on it, unfortunately. Leveraging electronic health information, pretty widespread awareness of that. The red bar is pretty big. We're at 93% saying this is somewhat or very important. 58% think it will impact their day-to-day work, and 57% saying that they want more emphasis on this. So there's a real opportunity there with electronic health information. Fostering a culture of quality improvement. This is a very interesting one to me because we have 83% recognizing it, 96% saying it's somewhat or very important to public health. That is the most important of all of these trends that we asked about, according to workers across the public health spectrum. 70% think it's going to have an impact on their everyday work, and 65% think that more emphasis should be placed on that. So I think given where we are with accreditation and how many health departments have engaged in that process and how much people are pushing quality improvement, people are not tired of it yet. People are seeing the value of it, and they're wanting more emphasis on it. So I think this is an interesting finding that really can be acted on. And then finally, cross-jurisdictional sharing of public health services. 72% are aware of it. That was actually higher than I thought it would be. 90% say that it's somewhat or very important. 61% think it's going to be impacting them on a day-to-day basis. And 47% think more emphasis should be placed on it in the future. So I'm going to move on to the workplace environment. As I said earlier, one of the things we really wanted to look at was, you know, if people are learning, are they then able to apply that in their work? So we wanted to know about the culture of learning. One of the things we asked about is kind of the support for professional development that a health department might provide. So we see that 62% said that they have a staff physician responsible for internal training. 80% said that the health department provides on-site training. 77% pay travel or registration fees for trainings. 92%, almost everybody, allows use of working hours to participate in training. But only 59% include education and training objectives in performance reviews, and then 30% require continuing education. We have some more items on culture of learning. 82% say that employees learn from one another as they do their work. Only half say they have enough training to fully utilize the technology they need for their job. Only 45% say their training needs are assessed. That seems to me like some low-hanging fruit. It doesn't take a huge amount of money to assess people's training needs, but only 45% are saying this is actually happening. 71% say that the supervisors and team leaders in the work unit support employee development, and only 57% say that their agency provides recognition of achievement. This is another one that seems to me like pretty low-hanging fruit. As far as job satisfaction goes, Brian mentioned that we found that job satisfaction was really pretty high. So if you combine that somewhat satisfied and very satisfied bar, you find that 79% of public health workers are somewhat or very satisfied with their job. So they like the work they're doing. They're less satisfied with the organization. if you combine the somewhat satisfied and very satisfied, you wind up with 65% saying that they're satisfied with the organization. And then, of course, you look at pay, even less satisfied with that. We've got 48% saying that they're satisfied with their pay. So the turnover issue. This is a lot of what Brian is talking about with the meteors coming down on the dinosaurs. We're looking at 38% saying that they're considering leaving or planning to retire by 2020. And this is retirements between now and 2020, and then people who are considering leaving this year. So we're not even looking at people who are considering leaving for reasons other than retirement in 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019. So it's actually going to be quite a few more than that 38% by 2020. Finally, I just want to give you a quick snapshot of the demographics. The breakdown by gender, I don't think any of you will be too surprised to see. More females than males. We're at 72% female. This was just the breakdown in terms of supervisory status. So non-supervisors were obviously people who don't supervise anyone. Team leaders were defined as people who might manage budgets and projects but aren't necessarily supervising others. Supervisors obviously have that supervisory responsibility, but they don't supervise other supervisors. So then the managers would be the ones who might supervise other supervisors. And then finally, executives were defined as those at the highest levels of the health department who would be in the senior executive service or the equivalent of that. When we look at race and ethnicity, what we found was that in most of these groups, it's fairly representative of the population these folks serve. But the big departure from that has to do with the Hispanic and Latino population. So the Hispanic and Latino population in the United States overall is about 17%, but in the workforce, it's only 7%. This was just a breakdown in terms of what kind of work people are doing, whether they're doing administrative work, more clinical or lab work. 41%, the biggest proportion, would be in public health science. And then social services we lumped with the sort of other categories, and that came out at 16%. So this is an interesting slide. This is where you see the age distribution of the workforce, and you can of course see that biggest bar is the 56 to 60 category. So that really tells you what's driving the 38% we see leaving before 2020. The average age of the public health worker was 48. Here you see the distribution by salary. It's a pretty nice bell curve with a little tail there at the high end. And you see the most common salary was in the $45,000 to $55,000 range. In terms of educational attainment, we see pretty well-educated workforce, 75% with a bachelor's degree, and then 18% with an associate's degree. So a lot of college education in this workforce. And keep in mind that we surveyed all of the public health workers in a health department. So it wasn't just those in the public health science field who you might expect to have a master's. It was everybody, including the administrative assistants and, you know, even the custodian and the guy who drives the shuttle service or whatever. 38% had some sort of a master's, 9% had a doctoral degree, but what we found was that only 17% had some sort of a public health degree. So a lot of folks in the public health workforce without formal training in public health, and of course that has some clear implications for practice. In terms of educational and attainment. When you look at this by age, the interesting thing that I find about this slide, if you look at the top, you're seeing the red line is the bachelor's degrees, the middle line is the master's degrees, and the purple line is the doctoral degrees. What you see here is higher education levels among the younger folks who are coming into the public health workforce. So in terms of the bachelor's, it's not a huge amount of variation around that 80% line. But when you look at that green master's line, you see really The youngest people coming in don't necessarily have their master's yet, but when you get to the 26 to 30 and the 31 to 35, that's where the highest prevalence of that master's degree is. And then the older workers really don't have quite as many master's degrees. And then the doctoral degree, you see what you might expect, which is that sometimes people get that doctoral degree much later in their careers. And so there's kind of a steady upward trend on that one. And then this is the same kind of slide, basically saying the same thing, but looking specifically at those public health degrees. And so that's where you see the trend is even sharper with the master's degree, you know, between the 26 to 30-year-olds having that master's degree, coming much lower, less than 10% of those over 50 having a master's in public health. Excuse me. Okay, so I just want to bring up a few points for discussion, and then we'll turn it over to Debbie to talk about Oklahoma, and then invite you to ask some questions about this. Again, I wanted to emphasize the point that this really was a great collaboration between PHWINS and ASTO. And I want to say that workers perceive the top training needs to be policy development and financial management, but also social determinants and cultural competency type of items came up as big training needs, and then also communicating persuasively might come out more as a training need if you think about it in terms of that policy development. We learned that morale was really fairly high, that workers see the importance of quality improvement and electronic health information and would like to see more emphasis in those areas. The workforce is aging. This is not a news flash, but this really is driving home just how much the workforce is aging. And by asking people individually about their plans to retire, as opposed to asking at the agency level who's eligible for retirement, we think we get a much more accurate estimate of who's actually going to leave. And then finally, a relatively small proportion of the public health workforce has any formal training in public health, and this is especially the case for the mid and later career professionals. So thank you very much. I'm going to turn it over to Debbie now.
All right, so good afternoon, everyone. I'm Debbie Boyer. I'm the Director of HR for the Oklahoma State Department of Health. Thank you for having me here. My part of the presentation is to give an overview at the state level of Oklahoma state data and then give you some information on our workforce development activities that we are undertaking. And let's see, again, technically challenged. There we go. All right, so before I get into Oklahoma's data, I want to just give you a little bit of background about the Oklahoma State Department of Health. Our mission is to protect and promote health, to prevent disease and injury, and to cultivate conditions by which Oklahomans can be healthy. And we carry that mission out with approximately 2,100 employees statewide. 75% of our employees are classified or merit system employees, and approximately 25% of those employees are at-will non-merit system employees. We supplement our workforce with just over 120 temporary employees and student assistants. Our turnover rate for fiscal year 2015 was 14.75%, which was an increase over our fiscal year 2014 turnover rate. We do have kind of a unique structure in that we have 68 county health departments that serve 77 counties statewide, and we have two independent city county health departments that serve our metropolitan areas of Tulsa and Oklahoma City. We also have partnerships, Turning Point coalitions in the community, over 60 of those, and we have 37 nationally recognized Native American tribes. So with the support of the De Valmont Foundation and ASTO, we were pleased to be invited to participate in the Public Health WINS survey. As you can see from this slide, we did have a 52% response rate with 1,116 of our employees responding to the survey. So beginning with Oklahoma's data, I will tell you that the data that's presented for the state of Oklahoma as well as the national comparisons includes data from our local employees at our county health departments, and that's why you may see some differences between what I'm presenting and what prior presentations included. All right, so from our workforce, we know that of those responding, we had 44% that were over 50 years old. 43% indicated that they had been with the health department for 5 years or less, and 21% planned to retire before the year 2020. We know internally, as late as October, that we had approximately 333 of our employees who are eligible to retire today. That's about 16% of our workforce. We also know from our agency exit survey data and other data that some of the reasons that these 16% are considering leaving that are other than retirement include things like promotional opportunities, compensation, work environment, family obligations, and then also finding a career in a different field. In terms of employee satisfaction, we had 81% of those surveyed that reported that they're somewhat or very satisfied with their job, which is a satisfaction rate that's higher than the national average of 79%. And the survey finding here is supported by a climate survey. We administer a climate survey agency-wide every 2 years. Our last climate survey, we had a 60% response rate, or 1,494 of our employees who responded. And our climate survey results indicated that we had 88% of our employees who indicated that their jobs were interesting, and 81% indicated that their jobs make good use of their skills and abilities. So our climate survey results support this particular finding from the PHWN survey. Again, turning to the PHWN survey, 67% of our employees reported being somewhat or very satisfied with their organization, which was slightly higher than the national average. And 45% of those report being somewhat or very satisfied with their pay, which was slightly lower than the national average. I will tell you that that number, the 45%, is higher than our last finding on our climate survey, but we have done a lot of work in compensation. At the end of year 2000 and into 13, we did market adjustments and equity adjustments, thanks to the leadership support that we had to raise salaries for many of our employees. I think 71% of our employees received pay increases during that time. So 55% of our employees who responded to the survey indicated that they're required to participate in continuing education training, which is higher than the national average. We do have certain in-service mandatory training requirements that we require our employees to participate in and complete. And we also have a large number, I'm sure like many of you, of professional positions that do require certification and licensure and thus require continuing education to meet those requirements. 78% of those who responded to the PHWN survey indicated they have the education and training objectives included in their performance evaluations. Again, that was a finding that was a little bit higher than the national average. Our performance evaluations, what we have done is we have included an accountability on every employee's performance evaluation, as well as every supervisor's performance evaluation, to ensure that staff meet their mandatory in-service training requirements. And we do give ratings if your staff do not meet the requirements that are less than means or exceed standards. So it is that important to us that we've incorporated into our performance management system. Also, our performance management system requires the collaboration between employees and their supervisors in the creation of individual development plans for our employees on an annual basis. And oftentimes what you'll see with those individual development plans is you'll see education and training need goals. 94% of our workforce indicated that they are allowed to use work hours to participate in trainings. That is true. We provide training and we support our employees in participating in training opportunities on work time. And then 88% of our employees indicated that we have funding available for travel and registration fees. I will tell you that the state of Oklahoma is facing some pretty significant budget concerns right now, and so hopefully not, but that could change a little bit. Continuing in the area of professional development, we have 88% of our employees who responded to the survey indicating that they have access to on-site training, and 71% have a staff position responsible for training. We do have a workforce planning and development area or unit. It's under the human resources umbrella. We have 5 staff in that area. three of which are training specialists that are required and as part of their job to create curriculum and deliver training in a classroom setting, not only for our central office in Oklahoma City, but regionally for our county health departments. We also offer a variety of training online as well as by video conference. And we're an affiliate with Train, which provides thousands of training opportunities online through our OK Train system, many of which are discipline specific. We're also fortunate in the state of Oklahoma that our State Office of Human Capital Management provides training for all state employees at no cost to the agencies. They publish an annual training agenda, and our employees can attend those training efforts as well. And the state of Oklahoma offers a certified public managers training program that provides 300 hours of management training at no cost to the employee. The agency, the Oklahoma State Department of Health, covers the cost of that training program and provides those training opportunities for our staff on work time. So turning back to the survey, 67% of our employees report that the department provides recognition of achievement, which again is above the national average. We do have a formalized recognition program. That's not where we'd like it to be. We'd like it to be a little bit higher, so we have some work to do in that area in terms of recognizing our employees. And 60% of our employees report that their training needs were assessed. That would be because in calendar year 2011, we did an agency-wide training needs assessment as part of our preparation for accreditation. And we did survey our employees for their training needs as well as the supervisors about their employees' training needs. Workplace environment strengths, we had 93% of our employees indicate that they believe that the work that they do is important, which is consistent, as you can see, with the national average. Based on our climate survey results, we had 85.8% tell us that they usually feel a sense of accomplishment when they complete their job. So our climate survey supports this PHLINS finding. 92% reported being determined to give their best effort at work every day, consistent with the national average. And 86% of our employees reported having a good relationship, working relationship with their coworkers. In terms of opportunities for improvement, we had 40% of our workers who responded indicating that they believe creativity and innovation is rewarded. That's slightly higher than the national average. But our climate survey indicated that we had 54.5% who felt that they were personally encouraged to be creative and innovative. So we have some work to do in that area. 43% of those who responded indicate that they believe communication between our senior leadership and our employees is good in the organization. That's slightly lower than the national average, and our climate survey data tells us that that's about 46% believe communication from leadership is open and honest. Communication is an area that comes up as an area of improvement on almost every climate survey that we do across years. 59% of our Oklahoma workers report having sufficient training to fully utilize technology needed for the work that they do. In the state of Oklahoma, we're fortunate to be able to contract with a career technology center for the provision of technology training. And as part of that contract, we have the ability to work with them on new technology training needs that we have. So the PHLINS survey also examined training needs, and it did so by calculating the proportion of employees who believe an identified skill is somewhat or very important to their current position, and also, as Dr. Sellers said, then asked the employees to rate themselves as either unable to perform in that skill area or that they were at the beginning level of that skill. That is similar to the approach that we took when we did our agency-wide training needs assessment, and that we ask employees what the level of importance was in terms of competency development, and we asked them to tell us what their needs were, and then we asked their supervisors to weigh in on that as well. K-12 Continuing with training needs, the PH1 survey indicated that of those responding from Oklahoma workers, 35% believe the skill in assessing the broad array of factors that influence public health problems is important, and they have low skills in that area. And then they also rated understanding the relationship between a new policy and many types of public health problems as important, but that they have a low skill in that area as well. These need areas from the PH1 survey will provide us an opportunity to, as we develop our next needs assessment, to ask some more specific questions, and based on this data, to drill down and get more information about those needs, so that then we can learn, then we can identify strategies to address the needs. 44% of Oklahoma workers believe that influencing policy development is a training need, and they have a low skill development, and 37% of our workers believe that preparing a program budget with justification also is a need area, as well as ensuring that programs are managed within current and forecasted budget constraints. What we have done to address this particular issue is we offer an annual Oklahoma Public Health Leadership Institute that currently does not include budget or financial modules, and we've put forward a proposal to build an entire new module for that Leadership Institute around budget planning, forecasting, and budget management. While 93% of those responding to the survey believe that communicating in a way that different audiences can understand is important, only 16% of our employees thought that they have a low skill level. But as I said previously, communication is an area that comes up on every climate survey that we do and other internal surveys as well. So in terms of national trends and questions about have they heard about the particular national trends, 76% of our employees indicated that they had heard about evidence-based public health, and 71% believe that it will impact their day-to-day work in a fair amount or a great deal. 55% of our employees,55% of our employees have heard of health and all policies, and of those, 92% believe that it's very important to public health, and 65% believe that it'll impact their work on a day-to-day basis. So what does all that tell us as a human resources department? What it tells us is that succession planning is essential. Based on those responding to the survey, we know that 21% plan to retire before 2020. We know that currently today, 16% of our workforce are currently eligible to retire. So that means we have some work to do to prepare our workforce effectively to move up into those positions when we have people who separate from employment with us. That means we have to provide opportunities for professional growth and development and resources and tools to help them prepare. We must also implement processes to capture and retain the institutional knowledge. When we have a large segment of the workforce retiring, we have a lot of knowledge going out the door. And to be frank, we are not quite so good at documenting those processes and retaining that knowledge for people who come to those positions when the others leave. So we have some work to do in that area. We have to continue to work to foster an environment that's creative and innovative. We have to continue to work on promoting a learning culture within the organization through things such as creating an effective mentoring program, a cross-training program, a job shadowing program, and other activities, project work, where we can more effectively prepare our employees to career progress within our agency. We also have to look at and identify what are the technology training needs. We know that we have technology needs from the PH1 survey. So one of the challenges that we have is when we get ready to do our next training and needs assessment, we need to ask some drill down questions to find out specifically what those technology needs are so that we can address them. And then, as I said, we have work to do on our budgeting, forecasting, financial management skills as well. So our next steps, What we've done is we've launched a workforce development team to improve our existing workforce development plan. We had a plan when we submitted and we were accredited, but we need to make our plan much more robust and much more forward-leaning, and so we are in the progress of doing that by establishing a team of folks from across the agency and across disciplines to help us with that effort. Our agency has just gone through a new strategic planning process, and one of the other things that we're challenged by is we need to make sure that our workforce development plan aligns with the new strategic map. So we have a team with representatives from all of our divisions. We have a senior leadership. We have a deputy commissioner who's agreed to serve on the team and be a champion for our workforce development efforts. And we are going to be using the ASPO Workforce Development Plan Guide Toolkit to guide our process. If you have not seen that, it's an excellent resource to guide your workforce planning efforts. One of our first steps has been to gather data. So we've looked at workforce demographics. We have the PH Winds survey results. We have our climate survey results. We have exit surveys and exit interview results. We're going to take all of that information and look at it and determine what is our current state so that we'll know what steps we need to take to improve. The reason that I really like the PH Wind survey results is because we can survey inside the agency, and we do fairly routinely, but the value of the PH Wind survey results is it gives you those regional and national comparisons outside of your health department, which is really valuable in your workforce planning effort. So as we go forward, we're going to use all of those data sources. We're going to do an inventory of all of our training opportunities that we have, look at all of our existing policies within the agency, examine public health policy, and do a training needs assessment agency-wide, and begin to form our workforce development plan based on all of that information. We have already established competencies. We've identified leadership competencies, and we've also identified and adopted the core public health competencies from the Council on Linkages, and that will form the basis of our training needs assessment. It'll be a competency-based, agency-wide training needs assessment. Once we get the assessment completed, then we will analyze the results, identify the gaps, and then develop specific action strategies that we can use to address those gaps based on priority. Additionally, one of the other things that we want to accomplish with our workforce development effort is we want to establish a process for identifying those processes that we have and being able to capture that institutional knowledge, as well as taking all of that information and connecting the dots with other processes, like our selection and hiring process, like our onboarding process, all of those pieces that we have in place that are not quite connected yet. And hopefully once we get that finished, then we'll have a good, solid workforce development plan to carry us into the future. Our plan right now is that the needs assessment will be administered by the end of this year, and it'll probably take us 6 to 9 months to get through our workforce development planning process. So thank you for being here. I apologize for my nervousness. And I want to say a special thank you to you all from the Des Moines Foundation, as well as ASPO, for giving us the opportunity to participate in the survey. You can just really never have too much information, and you know what you know from inside your agency, but really having that national comparison really helps inform your workforce planning efforts. So hopefully I'll talk to you all soon, and thank you.
Well, there really is no wins without the state participation, so that's really key, and we appreciate that. Anybody, just before we take questions, what's the theme of APHA this year? Anybody remember? Health and Health Policies, but only half of the state governmental public health workforce knew what it was. And actually, when you step down to is it important, that number drops, and should you include it in, you know, should there be more focus on it, it drops again. So according to the state agency workforce, this is a pretty wasted conference. That's a problem, right? And that's what WINS is supposed to do, is point those things out. So with that, I think we are all happy to take questions. Yes, ma'am, in the back.
Can you talk more about the method of how you develop the survey, how you do
Yes, thank you for that question. I'm very embarrassed, actually, because I said I was going to talk about the methods, and then the slides I had up here, it was the wrong slide deck. So I switched computers on Friday and somehow wound up with the wrong slide deck. So I'm happy to tell you about the methods. So I'm kind of winging this, so feel free to come back to me with the things that I forget to mention. So this was an online survey. We fielded it in the end of 2014. We had 37 participating states. We also did a local pilot. So we had we had one sample of state health agency central office employees. We also did a local pilot. So we didn't want to try to survey individual workers in all 3,000 health departments the first time doing this. So we did a local pilot in about 5 states. We also surveyed Big City Health Coalition members who wanted to participate, and I believe there were 14 cities that participated. And then we also, interestingly, got quite a few local health department responses from state health agencies, and I'll tell you how that happened. The way we fielded it was to go to each state health agency that was participating and ask them for a staff list. So we wanted the name, email, you know, whatever, phone number of every single person in the health department. And we asked for the central office employees, but sometimes they gave us a list that we later found out had a whole lot of local health department employees who were employed by the state but working in the local health departments from the survey responses. So in a centralized state, you might expect that because those local health departments are units of the state health department. But it happened in other states as well, so we got quite a few locals that way. So let's see, what else did you ask me? Yes. Yes. We invited everybody to participate, and 37 agreed. So our main focus was on the state health departments, but then we did that local pilot, and so we tried to engage states of all the different kinds of governance relationships. So some centralized states, some shared, some decentralized, and then mixed sort of took care of itself. So I know Washington and Wisconsin were the two states where at the state level, they agreed to participate in the local pilot. And what I mean by that is that we went to the SACHO, to the State Association of City and County Health Officials, and we said, would you be willing to do this? And they said yes. And so then they opened that survey up to all the local health departments in that state.
And if you're having trouble sleeping, there is a very long, very arduous paper on just the methods. The whole paper. It's J.P. Leiter was the lead author, and you can find that in the journal supplement, but don't read it while you're driving. Dr. Dijak.
So it's my privilege to bounce back and forth across the country and meet with groups that are working primarily in environmental health. In the spirit of being provocative, I'd like to suggest that, in fact, I first honor people that have worked for a very long time in the profession. But if they want to retire, they should do that and move on. What I'm finding across the country are people who've been in the workforce for a long time. They retire and then somehow angle their way right back in leadership positions. That's actually stifling creativity. As you noticed when you presented, a young workforce, highly educated, they're ready to take the mantle of leadership. And frankly, I'm not as worried about that retirement surge. Also, with the folks that intend to leave the workforce, what I heard from the Nature Board this last year is that what they're seeing is a mobile workforce. People work for the local health department, they go to the private sector, 2 years later they come right back. And they're actually learning to live with that. I'm not sure if there's any comments you guys would like to react to relative to this issue.
Well, Rivka's paper does a good job at looking at why people are leaving and where they're going. So there's good data on that. We are working on analyses that do some generational subgroups so that we can see those differences between, you know, not as adjusting in the model, but actually you know, generation-specific models to say how does this factor influence the millennials versus in the boomers versus in the Gen Xers. I think it's good questions. I think these are provocative questions. I don't know that we had a question that asked, like, have you already retired and come back?
No, we didn't have a question on that, but we do on the what is now called the Forces of Change survey, which I'm sure Dave knows that NACHO does the survey, but ASTO does the Forces of Change survey. And one of the questions we ask in there is, you know, we know health departments have been having budget cuts for years. What are your cost-saving strategies? What are the ways you deal with that? And one of them is rehiring retirees because, you know, clearly you can save some money that way. So we can tell you how many health departments are doing that, but we can't tell you how many people are doing that.
I think we need to shine a light on that issue because I think it's a challenge for retaining the mid-level workforce that's looking to move up the change.
Yes, I would say I also think the provocativeness of that statement can be problematic because I'm not sure I'm willing to go out there and say, we don't want you people anymore. Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
A successful presentation for me is when I make Katie uncomfortable. So that's always a trick. Yes, ma'am.
So I was struck by the excellent presentation, which is by Katie. Yeah. One of the many things that certainly has the National Library Medicine, and I'm interested in this question about how we support knowledge-based, evidence-based practice and the like. And just the idea that there might be a difference between the responses in places that are either accredited already or intending to go through accreditation versus those where accreditation is just something that's out there in the environment. And that is, you didn't ask the question, are you aware of accreditation, although maybe that's in the set that you asked. And so the question is, is this an analysis that's already done? When I go read the journal, I will see that it's an article that's already been written, or is this an analysis that's waiting to be done? Because it seems to me that if you haven't connected with, say, the annual report analysis that Jessica Cronstadt and the BAM people are doing, it would be interesting to marry your analyses in terms of what they're finding in terms of the after effects of having gone through accreditation and the idea of having perpetuate the commitments that you have to make institutionally to make accreditation work long term to this sort of workforce commitment and the kinds of things that, you know, where you were describing that sound very different than, say, some of the public health environments that I've had the pleasure of being part of over the years.
Yes. So the status of that paper is that Rivka and Mike Morris met about it yesterday. They are working on it. I know they have some super preliminary ideas about what the data are showing, but I don't know that they're willing to talk about that yet.
Actually, we're going to spend 2:30 today. But it's only on one niche within that. There's much, as you point out, much more to go in. We're just looking at the quality, the implications of accreditation, quality improvement, knowledge, and or awareness, and importance and impact.
Well, the part that I'm particularly interested in, just hearing for a moment, is again this question of what do we need to do to support evidence-based public health practice? Because there was this overall difference between folks who understood, yes, it's important, and no, I'm really not prepared to deal with it. And it really is still an evolving construct, and it's either old wine in new bottles, or it really is a change in attitude towards what the workforce needs to be able to do in terms of manipulate data, find, analyze information, figure out what's good analysis, what's bad analysis, bring stuff outside into the analysis. That's all of that range of things. And for example, the National Library of Medicine.
There's a whole lot of additional knowledge that we can glean from the PhD lens related to that. True. But as you brought out, also working with Fab, and I actually was talking just after a session yesterday about that very same issue. Right now, most of their stuff is more qualitative in nature.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm from Public Health Agency Canada. I I was pretty struck by a finding that you had, Dr. Scheller, and I'd like you to speak to as well, Koi, if you could, around more than 80% of people said they learned from each other on the job, but 45% of people said they also don't have what it takes to do their job, particularly in the technology field, right? So I was wondering, like, how those two things match up. We can learn from each other, but we don't have to do this. And how do people feel about learning from each other? People, especially people who are selected as mentors or were asked to mentor, because we've had experience that's been both positive and negative with mentors in the workplace. Sometimes people feel it's really, really positive, and other times people feel, you know what, I already got a job. So can you ask about that in the survey?
So I think that's a really interesting question, and I'm not sure there's anything I can say about the survey that would enlighten this disconnect between the vast majority of people saying we learn from each other as we do our work, and then only half saying I know what I need to know to use my technology. The only thing I would throw in there is that third piece, which is that this workforce is old. And so, you know, if you're of the older generation, and I know this is just a stereotype, but if you're of the older generation, you're uncomfortable with your technology, and the people that you tend to learn from as you work are also of that same generation and also equally challenged, perhaps, you know, perhaps it's more intergenerational learning that needs to be taking place that's not taking place. I mean, maybe your senior management is not learning from your entry-level people who might be much more facile with the technology, but this is just my personal thoughts. That's not in the survey.
I think that for us, we have an onboarding program, and part of that onboarding program is that the areas are to assign a mentor, and we've kind of had mixed results with that. Exactly what you said. Some folks take that mentorship role very much to heart and try to take the new employees under their wing and kind of show them the ropes, and others kind of view it as it's just another job duty that I have to do. So I think one of the implications that we're talking about is for agencies like mine, we need to really look at our onboarding processes and other processes and see where we're using mentors, are they effective or are they not, and really reaching out to the employees that are coming on board and seeing from their opinion, is that effective or would there be other ways that we could approach that? I'm not sure that that answered your question, but that was an implication that I got from the discussion.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting presentation. And I was wondering if anybody had looked at international level civil service tests and some of the civil service commissions. I wasn't sure how it counted, 75% or merit commission, which is that the unionized, basically, and then 25% not?
We're not unionized, but we are a merit system employer, but I can tell you that the state of Oklahoma, we used to be mostly test-driven, and our new human capital management office has gotten away from tests, and now it's really based on a questionnaire analysis in terms of your education and experience and the work that you've done in terms of qualifying for a position.
Okay. In New York City, there's an effort to have all people who work for city government come off of sort of tests and lists, except for a few sort of exempt titles. And to me, it sort of, it poses a challenge for getting the tests done about the skill sets that we necessarily are talking about today. And I just wonder if anybody had
here or anybody in the room has addressed that in their own state or city. So, I'm Heather Krasner from the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, and I wanted to touch base on this because I wrote a book on jobs in public service, and I looked at all the states and some larger cities and counties, and I just wanted to chime in that if you're looking for a younger workforce, this concept of having to register and sit for a test is completely bizarre to most job seekers who are actually trying to enter the workforce. And then you're talking for the federal level, the USA Jobs resume, which there's actually books written on how to write a better type of resume, and the fact that there is a book on this tells you that it is completely bizarre, and why is there such a hurdle for your typical person to get into these fields. So I feel like this is actually a challenge, potentially even a barrier to employment for people who may be just graduating from the MPH world. But I also just wanted to mention that it's not about civil service tests, but only 7% of my graduates each year from the graduate, the MPH and PhD in the Mailman School go into state or local government every year, or at least last year. And on a national level, there's recently been a pilot survey through ASTPH on employment outcomes. And on a national level, the pilot survey found that on the MPH level, it's 19% of graduates that go into any level of government, federal, state, local, tribal, whatever, 19%. And on the doctoral level, it's only 13%. So I guess my question is, again, how do we bridge this gap? We have our graduates from graduate schools of public health. How do we better connect them to the local and state health departments? And why is it so few that are going into this realm? And I don't think it's a civil service test per se, but there's more to this equation that I think we can open a line of communication here between where the graduates from public health schools going and what are the needs on the level of the state and local government, and how do we connect dots better?
So let's also think of this from the other side as well. There's a great piece from New York City. I think Carolyn Green was the first author, where in New York City they surveyed hiring managers and asked, do the MPHs have the skills that you need as a hiring manager in a health department? And they said no. So that's a good piece to reference. But I think this is a useful dialogue. And how do we, you know, engage this workforce as the workforce is leaving? It's multifaceted, and I think it is how, you know, I'm engulfed in this literature at the moment because I'm writing the three papers on the millennial group, and just the attitudes, having been in state government and local government, this concept of, you know, I don't need to pay my dues to be respected, I want to be more creative, I want a flexible work, it's like, bam, 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 it has nothing to do with what governmental public health service was. I will, you know, recall a time when I got to Georgia in 2010, our Title V needs assessment was due in 6 months. And I asked the group, I said, what have you done so far? And they said, we've waited for you. And so we had 6 months to do a three-year project, and we pulled it off. 600 pages, one of the best needs assessments we'd done in that state. And my boss, who was not from government, said, take 5 days off. Don't put it in the books. Just go. And you deserve it because you've worked 1,000 hours. And that was great. And I said, you're not from government. I am. But okay, we'll see how this goes. Until HR came down and said, don't do that. We can't account for where you are, and that's just not going to work. And they get you fired. And that's just not, again, it's not the systems that support what our millennials want. And so I think
Brian,
this is a really important...
I think you're making Debbie uncomfortable.
Am I making Debbie uncomfortable? Would you have come down and told me not to do that?
I'm on.
There you go. Other questions? We have time for... One more. Okay, how about over here?
Thank you all for the presentation and for the work you're doing. I definitely agree that this is a very productive exercise. It sets up good dialogue when we're starting to have here. The question I ask, given the comments that Dr. Sellers made about the methodologies used, is whether you all or anyone is envisioning a similar kind of survey effort that would be reasonably comprehensive at the local level for local health. That's another piece of the puzzle here that worth thinking about.
It's a question. The you know, states are easier because the frame is better articulated. The Big Cities Health Coalition is easier because the frame was better articulated. Now you get to 3,000 health departments, of which we don't have a particular frame. We don't know every. We don't have a list of every health department. And what's the I'll speak as a funder here. What's the tipping point on return on investment? Is it the 500,000 and above, the 100,000 and above, the 50,000 and above? Am I really surveying a health department of five people? Is that useful? Is that worth the investment? And so as we, you know, I think we hope, I can say, we hope that there will be a PH wins 2 and 3 and 4 and 5. And we just need to sit down with NACHO and figure out, you know, what's the tipping point and what's the right number to do a survey versus something else. So last question.
Actually, I have two very fast questions. So I'm from an academic institution that produces both baccalaureate-trained and MPH-trained, and we're going to be doing our PhD shortly. And so if you had a wish list based on this study, what kind of curricular changes should we be making so that we would have graduates at baccalaureate level who'd be much better fitted to go into these, because our MPH students are really creative. And they do go other places. very, very interesting. So you have a much larger pool here of baccalaureate trained public health, you know, that's so many. So how would you change your curriculum to really be able to address it? Yeah,
and I don't mean to put Debbie on the spot, but Debbie may know what Oklahoma needs in terms of these graduates.
I really think that it kind of fits with what our need areas are that we've talked about. We need people who know how to do budgets, who know technology, who know the business of public health and stay up on public health and public health policy and that sort of thing. I think that the government aspect is somewhat challenging to recruit those employees. I'm not sure that that's exactly what we're looking for.
Let me suggest Googling Thinking Beyond the Silos, the first author of Kaufman, the three top training needs: systems thinking, communicating persuasively, and change management. And I think, you know, we are exceptional scientists. You know, we are exceptional scientists in public health. But if you buy into the T principle, right, so the T principle in employment is you have the stick of the T, which is the depth in your professional area, and then the crossbar of the T is your ability to work across many professional areas. We are great sticks, we are awful crossbars, and we need to be better crossbars. So I don't know that it's, you know, it's really how do you get those skills into the workforce so that when they get there, they're ready to talk not to other public health people, but to transportation and agriculture and know that language and don't feel like they have a, you know, this is my silo and I'm an epi and I don't want to talk to that other person. So,
and so just as a next step forward, ASCPH is getting a large network of undergraduate programs together. This is an opportune time to begin that conversation about the competencies that a baccalaureate trained person could walk into a health department and be very strongly contributing.
And if you go to the de Beaumont booth, there's an exceptional infographic on the growth of the undergraduate workforce. We quantified the growth in the conferrals between, I think it was 92 and 2007. But it shows just tremendous growth and that there is a group there that we need to tap into. So thank you guys for coming. The one thing to remember, public health right now, it is not golf. This is not time to be silent. It's not appreciated or warranted. Little golf claps don't help us. Get mad, make change, save the workforce. Thank you.